Hi, I'm John Weber. My guest today is alto saxophonist and composer Rudresh Mahanthappa, who combines the sounds of South Indian classical music and progressive jazz. The Chicago Tribune says he takes listeners into fascinating Eastern idioms that are otherwise virtually unheard in jazz today. His musical innovation has earned him a Guggenheim Fellowship, and he was voted Alto Saxophonist of the Year by the Downbeat Critics Poll 2 years running. Rudresh, welcome to Piano Jazz.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, John.
It's an honor. When did you first develop an interest in traditional music from India?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, I didn't grow up with a lot of Indian classical music. My parents listened to some bhajans, which are like the religious, like devotional music that occur, you know, at Hindu temples and ceremonies and such. You know, embracing Indian music was more about discovering who I am as a person, you know, coming into my own as a bicultural entity, you know. I mean, I've been very concerned with expressing what it means to be an Indian American, you know. I'm not Indian, I'm not American, I'm both, I'm neither. I inhabit both of these worlds and kind of another region in between, you know, 24 hours of every day. So it's important for me to put that forth in the music that I'm making. So I think I started becoming really interested in Indian music as a real art form which I could draw upon when I was 18 or 19 years old, which was the same time I was trying to figure out who I was. You know, I grew up in Boulder, Colorado, which was a primarily white community, but I started music school at North Texas State University, and which had a significant African-American population. And I think that's when my eyes kind of opened. I said, well, I'm not black and I'm not white, so who am I exactly? You know, and another problem that I had was that people often looked at me and looked at my last name and assumed I would be an expert on Indian music. So another struggle I had was to actually figure out how to deal with Indian music on my own terms and to what degree I wanted to and what I really wanted to take from it.
Well, when did you first realize that the Indian music of your heritage could coexist with jazz?
Really, truly, I think it all happened for me at there was a very important concert that I attended in Bangalore in 1994. I just finished at Berklee College of Music, and Berklee had decided to send a student band to India to do... There used to be a festival there called Jazz Yatra that occurred in many cities over the course of, you know, a week or 10 days. And Berklee kind of sent what they would call these all-star bands to India to play these gigs. And it was really amazing for me because it was my first time going to India as an adult, and it was my first time going to India without my parents. And it was my first time going there as a musician. So it was like, and I hadn't been there in 10 years on top of that, or more than 10 years. So I was very nervous because I was confronting India in terms of this identity crisis that had been burgeoning, you know, for quite a while. So we went to this one concert. In India, there's this tradition of these all-night concerts. They start at sunset and they go until sunrise. It's an amazing, beautiful experience. And we went to one of those just outside Bangalore. It was an outdoor concert, beautiful. And I later found out that I had seen some of the major stars of North and South Indian classical music. And just some of the stuff I heard that night still rings in my head very clearly. Just the rhythmic propulsion and the astute musicianship and the complexity of the improvisations, it all made sense to me. You know, I heard that the way I was hearing Charlie Parker and Coltrane and, you know, Michael Brecker and, you know, whoever else. I heard it commingling in my mind in a very unique way. And it obviously took a long time for that to actually come out in my music. But that was it. That was a real pivotal moment for me.
Well, I'd like to play something from the tradition just to start out, because that's what I do better than playing Indian classical music or some other Eastern music. From there's a special name for Indian classical music. What is that name again?
Indian classical music is really, you know, there's North Indian and there's South Indian, which are quite different in approach and very different in instrumentation. You know, in the U.S. we think of sitar and we think of tabla. In the West we generally, that's where our mind goes when we think of Indian music. But those are actually Hindustani. Those are North Indian instruments. In the South, the equivalent would be the mridangam. That's the major percussion instrument. Yeah, it's like a barrel, two-headed barrel drum. And the equivalent of the sitar would be like the veena.
Hmm.
And that's called Carnatic music. That's South.
Carnatic, that's what I was thinking of, yes.
Right.
You know, I'd like to actually choose a tune from that tradition, maybe just like a blues or something. I don't know. What do you think? I'd like to play one with you.
Oh, I love playing blues. You know, one of the first blues heads I learned was Sonny Moon for Two.
Oh, yeah. Sonny Rollins.
That'd be a lot of fun.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Man, you are burning.
I'm trying to keep up with you, man.
Oh, please, please. Here, you've got all this numerology and all this wonderful, I mean, in addition to just playing soulful, hot, smoking, burning blues, it's just, I'm trying to keep up with the numbers and the chords and the math, and it's just genius. It's great.
Well, you know, I'm in good company here, so thank you. It's just so fun to play blues, and sometimes, you know, I write a lot of my own music, and you know, I don't find myself in many situations where I just get to play some blues. So this is a real treat for me.
I hope it's nice and nostalgic, because I know you did it a lot in college, and you have been writing quite a bit since your days at Berkeley. And I'm going to be brave, and I'm going to try playing one of your compositions, because I admire your work so much, and I'm going to give it the old college try.
Well, I appreciate it. This is one called Blackjack, and You know, people talk about, with Indian music, there's a big challenge people have on the surface of the rhythmic structures being complicated. And I think there are ways, even with our very Western-oriented ears, that we can hear those rhythms in the same way we heard that blues that we just played and, you know, played from the seat of our pants. And this is a tune where I was kind of trying to experiment with that. It's called Blackjack because it's actually 21 beats. But really, if you didn't know that and just, you know, listened to it and learned it by ear, you would be tapping your foot and would have no idea that it's 21 beats. And that's something that I try to impart when I'm teaching, when people are overwhelmed by, you know, kind of non-Western rhythmic structures. Like, you know, you can still dance to any of the stuff. You can still tap your feet to it. And you can also internalize it. Don't let the numbers and don't let the dark cloud of complexity, you know, obscure your perception of this. You know, this is rhythmically propulsive music. I want you to be able to feel this the same way you feel, you know, house music when you go to the discotheque.
Well, I'm a beginner. You've had about 20 years of experience head start on me, but I'm going to give it a good shot.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I got through it.
Oh, you did more than get through it, John. That was great.
That was a blast.
That was a lot of fun.
There are times I know I fell off the rails a little bit, but man, it's just, I felt good. When it locked, when you were playing the same thing as me in the right place, I was so happy. And it's great, yeah.
I mean, I thought it was cool. You know, I mean, we got into a lot of different spaces and there was a high level of interaction. And, you know, those are the things that are important to me. I mean, you know, anyone can write really complicated music or deal with complicated concepts. But, you know, at the end of the day, you want to create scenarios where people are really communicating with each other. People are really interacting. And we just did quite splendidly, as far as I'm concerned.
It's a really interesting groove. And I honestly felt like getting up to dance. In fact, if I stood up a couple of times, it was because I was starting to dance. I was starting to actually get it.
Right, for sure. And, you know, and that's the idea. I don't want anyone to be counting. You know, we don't. A lot of the music that we enjoy listening to, we're not sitting there counting, whether we're musicians or non-musicians. And that's the idea. We're trying to create situations where we are feeling the music and we're enjoying the music and hopefully taking it in both in our left brains and right brains. You know, for me, the most inspiring musicians have always been the ones that were simultaneously gut, seat of the pants, and intellectual. You know, there's that balance, I think. You know, I think Bach and Beethoven were like that. I think Bartok was like that. I think Bird and Train and Prince and Beyoncé and, you know, there's a lot of great country music and folk music that's really emotional but very smart at the same time. And that's the music that I look up to. That's the music that makes me want to get up in the morning.
Do you think that, me too. It does make me want to dance and it does make me feel something. And you have certainly worked with enough musicians who have that sort of incisive musical ethic that you just described.
Right.
Do you think that maybe a generation or two in the future, we'll hear more assimilation of global influences in mainstream jazz like the ones we just played?
Oh, for sure. Definitely. I mean, I think it's happening at such a quick rate now. You know, I hear these young bands, both in, you know, in the U.S. and Canada and Europe as well, actually, where they're already like leaps and bounds, you know. I mean, they're further in than me. You know, I had some students up in Toronto that, you know, they've gone and lived in India on and off for like the last 5 years, and I mean, they know more than me, really. You know, they've absorbed a lot, and I see not. I mean, we have two things happening. I mean, we obviously have. The main thing that we have happening is access to information. We have the internet. We can we can listen to any type of music from any part of the world in an instant on our iPhone. And that's something that you and I didn't grow up with. And I mean, I think it's a mixed blessing, but what we end up with is an eclecticism that's broader than it's ever been. You know, music lovers today have the most eclectic tastes that they've ever had in history.
Well, in your early playing days, when you were in your 20s, kind of finding your way and finding your identity, what kind of stuff would you play at a jam session? What would you typically call in those days?
Well, I felt like for a long time I only knew about five tunes. And one of them I always liked to call was There'll Never Be Another You. And it was really one of the first tunes I learned and also had a chance to kind of experiment with maybe. And even with students sometimes, if they know There'll Never Be Another You, I always use that as kind of a jumping off point to talk about lots of different things. But, you know, it's a lovely melody. I love playing it.
Me too. We should do it together.
Let's do it. Thank you.
Rudresh, that was just way too much fun.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was so great. You know, like, I haven't played that tune in years, so that just felt really good and brought back a lot of good memories. It was a real treat.
I'm honored that you play it with me. Well, there's more coming up with Rudresh Mahanthappa. I'm John Weber, and this is Piano Jazz from NPR Music. I'm having so much fun playing with you. Man, you are just tearing it up today, Rudresh.
It's such a refreshing thing to step back and draw from this kind of large body of the history of this music. It kind of, for me, it recontextualizes what I'm doing when I'm playing my original music. I can hardly wait to go play with my band again and see what this experience does to that.
So when did you start writing music for your bands?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was actually a band leader as early as ninth grade, I think, and trying writing tunes back then even. And, you know, it was really funny. We had a little fusion band. We were trying to play Brecker Brothers tunes and Bird tunes. And I would love to hear that now. But, you know, I got very serious about writing and leading, you know, when I was in college. I really wanted to start putting together something that felt like it was my own. So, you know, I was like 19, 20. Yeah, I was 19 or 20 years old. And I have to say, as a jazz musician, you know, there are all these things that we're supposed to be able to do. You're supposed to be able to play blues, and you're supposed to be able to play a ballad and tell a story, sing your own song. You know, we're kind of beaten over the head with these kind of these ideas, or they're almost like morals or something like that. And I actually had a very difficult time playing a ballad. You know, I had a difficult time figuring out how to express myself on something like Body and Soul or In a Sentimental Mood or Round Midnight or these beautiful, wonderful ballads that have, you know, spanned the history of this music. I mean, I've consequently gotten better at them. But I have to say that, you know, the first ballad I heard that really spoke to me in this very emotional, tear-jerking sort of way was Coltrane's Dear Lord.
Oh, God, yes.
And then some of his, you know, his other ballads in that period, if we're, you know, we're talking about, you know, in the 60s, 1962 to 65, he played these ballads that were, you know, it's almost like he's standing at the edge of a cliff, you know, playing for the universe in front of him or something. And I wanted to write something like that or evoke that kind of, that spirit, that energy, that imagery. So one of the first tunes I wrote back then in the early 90s was this tune called Hope that I still to this day play with different bands of mine. It has this kind of very timeless feel to me, and it's always relevant to what's going on in my life and what's going on in the world around me.
Yeah, I would love to hear it, and I'd love to play it.
Yeah, I'd love to play it with you. Thank you.
That's really a pretty tune, man.
Oh, thank you. That was a lot of fun. You know, that it's great because it's different every time, you know, that there's so much open space in there. So I think for me, you know, if we waited 2 hours and played it again, it would be radically different because we would feel different. We would know each other maybe a little bit better. We'd know something different about each other. You know, it's such a great open field for us to communicate.
Yeah.
And just kind of talk about what hope means in a musical way for us in this moment.
Yeah, very poetic. I mean, this is something that you wrote when you were in your 20s. So you were at that youthful, hopeful, you know, before the grim face of adulthood stared you right in the face.
Right, exactly.
When you were that young, were you playing tenor or alto, or who were you listening to? I should ask you what saxophone players, what type of horn you were listening to.
Well, you know, I always played alto. I mean, I played a little bit of tenor in high school. Tenor never really felt right to me from a playing point of view. It always felt a little big. It just didn't resonate with my physical structure, I think, in the way that it does for others. But I was always really inspired by tenor players. You know, obviously, you know, we talked about Bird, and Bird is a huge influence, of course, but, you know, after Bird, if we're talking about the chronology of the music, I gravitated more towards the tenor players. You know, it was Coltrane and Hank Mobley and, you know, George Coleman and, you know, and then later, you know, David Liebman, Steve Grossman, Michael Brecker, and Joe Lovano, for that matter. You know, there's something about the tenor. I've always tried to figure out how to play like a tenor on the alto. And I mean that in many ways. I'm talking about sound, my actual sound as an alto player, and the registers I like. I like playing at the bottom of the horn a lot. And also, you know, vocabulary. You know, I think after Bird, you know, maybe with the exception of Cannonball, the tenor became the horn of innovation. You know, Coltrane kind of blazed this path and opened up all these doorways for us. So, yeah, and then, of course, Joe Henderson was an undeniable force, and I was fortunate to see him live a few times, and it was always amazing, and the recordings are always amazing, and to see his development is really fabulous. It's really wonderful, and one of the first tunes I learned of his was this tune, Recordame, which, again, kind of takes me back to those jam sessions 17 years ago, but, you know, it's funny, you call these tunes at the sessions and you always get the jaded folks that roll their eyes and say, oh, God, Recordame again. But, you know, you can make something really wonderful night after night playing the same music if you really want to. You know, if the energy is there and the, you know, the momentum and the drive is there. And I think that's the great challenge. You know, take a tune that we've heard 500 times and see if we can play the heck out of it.
Of course, of course. And the version you play 2 hours later will be a different one.
Absolutely.
So let's do it, man.
Cool. Thank you.
Man, you killed it again.
Yeah, that was really cool. I mean, I like this, you know, just over the course of this time we've been playing together, we've already developed a real musical relationship. And, you know, I like this idea of this kind of open conversation that kind of falls into a tune. It reminds me of, you know, it's almost in the tradition of musicals where they're talking about something and someone breaks into song. It's like we did that in this very abstracted sort of 21st century sort of way. You know, maybe what was the Woody Allen movie that was a musical with Alan Alda and
Everyone Says I Love You?
Yeah. You know, that was that had this certain, you know, very complex absurdity that I really liked, because it was even more unlikely that Alan Alda was breaking into song. At least it was for me, you know. So I thought that was kind of our version of that.
Yeah, man. And all this energy. I mean, I don't know where I'm getting it from. I mean, I feel like a kid again.
Well, I feel like that too, you know. I'm running on fumes. We just had a baby pretty recently. So, you know, it's fun for me to kind of wade through the fumes and try to make something that we all want to be a part of.
Yeah. Do you play any music for the baby yet? Is the baby receptive to your playing?
I haven't actually played saxophone for him yet, just because of our We just moved as well, so I haven't tried playing in my apartment yet. And, you know, babies have their crazy sleep schedule too. But I've been playing a lot of music for him and trying to play a wide variety of stuff for him, actually. Played him some Bjork, played him some Coltrane, some Bartok, some Beethoven symphonies, a whole variety of things. He seems to really like the piano, I have to say. Like, as soon as a piano comes in, he really perks up. So, and it's fun to experience this music that I've been listening to, you know, for a long time through his ears. You know, I feel like I'm kind of hearing it for the first time again. It's really amazing.
Well, if you had your alto in your hand and you were in his room and he was trying to get to sleep, what do you think you'd play for him?
You know, I would probably play him something like Hope, you know, something like that. That would be fun. But, you know, I think there's this great tradition of ballads that came out of, you know, Tin Pan Alley. And one ballad I really like is I Can't Get Started.
Yeah, I would love to wrap up the show with that one. That'd be pretty.
The first time I heard it was played by Benny Carter. And, you know, Benny Carter, I feel like people don't talk about him enough. He was really one of the great alto players. And he lived well into his 80s, if not 90, in his 90s. And, you know, I always, when I play this tune, I think about him. And I think about where I was when I first heard it. And it's very meaningful, very powerful for me. And definitely something I'd like to pass on to my boy.
Well, I would love to play it with you.
Let's do it.
Wow, Rudresh, thanks for being on Piano Jazz, man. You were brilliant.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. It's wonderful to actually be here.
Our pleasure.